Okay, so it is 12:40 on January, Thursday, January 28th, and we are doing alkyne chemistry. So let me see where, that's what I want. And the main thing that we left off with last time is we were talking about the acidity of alkynes, and that's where we kind of left off. And what we didn't show was the sort of utility of being able to use that. So with the acidity of alkynes, one of the things that we can do is we can take a terminal alkyne like this, and we can react it with a base, sodium amide. And this is usually done in liquid ammonia if we're doing this. There's other solvents that we could use, but these are also done fairly cold. We said that this was a temperature of convenience because that's the temperature at which liquid ammonia auto-cools itself, and so it always goes to this temperature. This makes the alkynyl anion, and we can represent this in a number of different ways. This way, I think, makes it as clear as possible that it is the alkynyl anion and the sodium cation. And then from there, we choose to react that with an appropriate electrophile to make a carbon-carbon bond. And so most of the time what we're doing is we're using something that is a primary alkyl halide. And this is an inherent SN2 reaction that we're looking at. And so what we do is we just follow through with the nucleophile attacking the primary position, kicking out the halide, and we make a new carbon-carbon bond. And we need to be careful that we number the carbons appropriately. So let's call this number one, number two, and number three. We are connecting at number one, number two, and number three. And that is our new carbon-carbon bond that we have formed right there. And if we wanted to, we can number the carbons on the nucleophile side too. This would be 1', 2', and 3'. And so we've connected carbons number 1 and 1'. And the reason that we need to do a primary alkyl halide is because if you think back, you all set?
Yeah, thank you for your help.
Yeah. Right, less chaos now. Now I can focus. Just calming, sort of take a deep breath as the frantic printing is over. The reason that it needs to be a primary alkyl halide is because if you think back to your SN2, SN1, E2, E1, that chapter, what we find is that when we have a really strong nucleophile like this, like an alkynyl anion, that this is so strong that it will function as a base if there is any sort of steric hindrance on the alkyl halide. So this with primary alkyl halides, like we've got here, we'll go through and do substitution. But if you go into a secondary or tertiary alkyl halide, what we get is we get elimination. And we will then go back to having the hydrogen there and it'll function as a base. Or on tertiary, we would get the same thing. We would get an elimination product that would occur as E2 reactions. And we would get the base, the conjugate acid back, essentially. So these two are choosing to go E2 reaction, because of the steric hindrance that is around, and that the steric hindrance ups the activation energy for the SN2 reaction, but it lowers the activation energy for the elimination reaction. So basically what's going on there is that alkynyl anion is choosing to function like a base, pulling the proton and kicking out the alkyl halide to give you the elimination reaction. Does that look familiar? And because of the low sterics on the primary position, then we can get the substitution And maybe instead of writing it, maybe I should actually draw that, since that's kind of what we're doing. And so here, what we would get is we would get our product. It would come out like that and get the substitution product. And the byproduct would be the sodium and the chloride, expecting that the sodium is the counter ion that is here and the chloride being kicked out. So the byproduct on the other ones would also be sodium chloride. It's just that we end up back with the alkyne. Okay, so these need to be primary alkyl halides, cannot be secondary or tertiary, otherwise they undergo elimination. So that's the big part with that. And that allows us to make carbon-carbon bonds, but we have to be selective about those carbon-carbon bonds. There are other substrates, such as aldehydes and ketones, things that we could react this with that we can make alcohols out of. Those get covered in the alcohol chapter. So for right now, we're just looking at reacting with alkyl halides to be able to make these carbon-carbon bonds. And from there, once we kind of get that down, what we do is we move into other reactions of the alkyne functional groups. And they have very similar reactions to the alkenes. So if you think about all of the reactions that you had with alkenes, they almost all work on alkynes in a slightly different way. So we need to take what we know from the alkenes and we're going to start applying it to the alkynes. So with that, we start an overview, going back over many of these different reactions that we did, and we'll remind you what those reactions look like, and we'll apply them to the alkynes. So let's start with that. Let's start with looking at the addition of acid to an alkene. So if I took and I did something like HBr, and I looked at the addition of an acid to an alkene, you guys know how this operates. So what we have is we have HBr, the double bond reaches out, grabs the proton. In grabbing the proton, it grabs it in such a way as to produce the more stable of the carbocations, right? So there's two possibilities. The other possibility is it could grab it this way and it could go for the primary. So this is an or. And yet what we find is that the secondary is more stable. And so this becomes the major pathway because the activation energy for that is substantially lower. And then what happens is the bromide now comes in and makes a bond and we get our product, which is the secondary bromide. And that's our major product. So we would say that we would get two products out of this, but we expect that secondary to be major, and that's our Makovnikov addition. So if we go back to that, the terms and the way that we describe these products, this would be our Makovnikov product. Okay, let's apply that to an alkyne. Let's do it with a terminal alkyne first. So here's a terminal alkyne, and we'll take and we'll react it with HBr. And we have to ask, well, what's going to happen when we do this? Maybe I'll slide this onto a new page so that we have room to. Work with this. Okay, so my first step is going to be exactly what I did before. I'm going to take HBr and I'm going to reach out and I'm going to grab the proton. And as I grab that proton, there are two possibilities, two possible outcomes, and I need to assess those two possible outcomes. So one of the first, and these are a little harder to draw. So you have to think in terms of, remember we talked about how important it was to look at the orbitals and understand where the orbitals are in this molecule, and also understand the hybridizations that we're creating when we do these additions to the alkyne. So what we're going to get is a double bond, and the proton can go out to the terminal end and I would get a positive charge that would reside in that position, or I would get the proton, adding to the side with the methyl group, and the positive charge resulting on the terminal end. And it looks funny, and I've drawn this straight, and you have to think, well, why did I draw this straight? And the answer is because this carbon is still sp hybridized, and it has an orbital that is an empty p orbital that represents that positive charge. And so being sp hybridized, it, oh, I'm on the wrong eraser. There we go. And this guy here is a p orbital. As such, it's linear. That carbon double bond to the methyl is linear, or the carbon double bonded here to this carbon to the hydrogen, that carbon is sp hybridized with an empty p orbital representing the positive charge. And my question is, which one of these is more stable? Do I expect that the positive charge in this position with the double bond and the methyl group more stable, or on the terminal end of the double bond, do I expect it to be more stable? And it goes back to exactly what we expected here. I mean, maybe you could tell me why I said that this one was more stable. And I said that because this was my secondary position versus my primary. So a secondary carbocation is more stable than a primary carbocation, right? But why is a secondary more stable than a primary? What model tells us that, or allows us to know that a secondary is more stable than a primary? First one is more substituted. So more substituted, but that's telling me that it's more substituted. That's not telling me why the carbocation is more stable. Yes, it's more substituted, but what does more substituted do? So BB, Ashley, you guys are right. Can spread out the charge. JC, that is correct. Can somebody tell me what model it spreads out the charge? Not resonance, Ashley, close. That's one of like the two answers that we could throw out. Resonance, if you don't know, throw out resonance quick. Induction is right. There's another way that we call it. We say hyperconjugation. So this is part of me also p orbital sharing. BB, I think that is absolutely descriptive, but we use a different language to describe it. So it's accurate. Induction is accurate. Let's draw what that model actually looks like. So when we have a carbon that has an empty p orbital, what we find is that when there is a carbon next to it, the carbon next to it and the sigma bond orbital that is here, so this is the sigma orbital. This sigma orbital contributes some electron density to the empty p orbital. And this is called hyperconjugation. That hyperconjugation is sort of a molecular orbital argument or reasoning to understand induction. It's not entirely induction. It's a little bit different than induction, because when we think about induction, induction really means to me the pulling of electrons. It's usually induction is, there can be things that are inductively donating, but usually we're talking about inductive withdrawing. And inductive withdrawing is an inherent electronegative element, which is sucking electron density away from an area. And here, what we're doing is we're donating electron density. And the carbon itself doesn't really have any electrons to donate to this carbon. So the model that we bring about is using the orbital itself where the electron density resides. And that's the sigma orbital, which is the orbital between the hydrogen and the carbon. That has some overlap with the empty p orbital, and that donates some electron density into that empty p orbital. That's the hyperconjugation model. And that's why, go for it, question.
I just started to interject. I just have like two quick questions. The first is that does hyperconjugation shorten that those carbon to hydrogen bonds?
That's a great question. And I think that with the, there's two models. Oh, get me going. Okay, there's two models. There's molecular orbital theory and there is natural bonding theory. Molecular orbital theory is looking at the molecular orbitals over the entire molecule. And natural bonding theory looks at the orbitals more or less isolated. They're equivalent theories. They give equivalent results, but different underpinning reasoning on how we argue things. And we typically tend to operate in the natural bonding theory area when we're doing drawings like this and talk about hyperconjugation. Molecular orbital theory would say that these orbitals don't exist independently of one another and cross and share in this way. Molecular orbital theory would say that what I would get out of this picture, if I were to do the same thing, molecular orbital theory would show me an image that looks like this. It would be the LUMO that I would be looking at, and the LUMO, being the lowest unoccupied molecular orbital, would have a pi bond, what looks like a pi bond, except it would skew this way. And then there would be the second lobe of the pi bond that would skew sort of this direction. And what that orbital is showing me, this being the LUMO, lowest unoccupied molecular orbital, one of these would be sort of yellow or orangey in the way that I'm coloring it in because it's unoccupied, and the other would be green. That indicates that these orbitals are unoccupied, as opposed to the blue and red coloring that we use for occupied orbitals. And because the density of the orbital overlaps an area where there is a bond, we're getting some donation of the electron density that is in this area into the empty p orbital. And so the p orbital shape then is spread across areas where there is electron density and being stabilized by its delocalization. And so it's delocalization by means of molecular orbitals. In the natural bonding theory, we would say that the orbital density here that is in the sigma bond is being donated into the p orbital. They are equivalent sort of theories and give us slightly different images, but essentially they serve to delocalize the positive charge. And in delocalizing the positive charge, we stabilize the molecule. We stabilize the ion. And that sort of stabilization is not available when it is on a primary position. The more substitution we have, the more alkyl groups that are attached to the positive charge, the greater the stabilization that we get. It's a nice little overview. So that's a great
question. My second question was just that the carbons involved in hyperconjugation for the charge deficient carbon, which is having like the delocalized electron donation, the carbon that's donating the electron density, does that one have to be sp3 hybridized to align with the p orbital?
It does indeed. Yes. Cool. And if it's not sp3 hybridized, if it's sp2 hybridized, that's where we get resonance. And so then the resonance allows the pi bond to align with the p orbital, and we get resonance instead of induction. So that's a great question. And back to your other question about shortening the bond, it probably does because it sucks some electron density out of it. That bond decreases in its size a little bit. That's a good possibility there. Okay, cool. And then this one is molecular orbital theory. Okay, so back to this now. Which one of these is more stable? Let's call this one A and B, so that we have a form of reference that people can sort of like throw out into the chat. Is A more stable or is B more stable? BB's going for A. Oh, I'm seeing some, they're all A's. Okay, I'm seeing all A's. That's actually astounding and exciting because it means that you all are understanding and you're doing exactly the right thing. Okay, A is more stable. Why is A more stable? Because we're looking at what is essentially a secondary position versus here a primary position. And so we're getting more stabilization in that secondary position than we would in the primary position. And indeed, that is correct. This is the more stable cation. And then remember that in a energy diagram, that what we are looking at is that as we go to that cation, that we're saying that the activation energy for the formation of that cation is significantly lower for the primary than it is for the, excuse me, backwards, for the secondary than it is for the primary. Good thing that I caught that. Okay, and it is the activation energy. Oh, and this is actually a great thing because it allows me to check in with you guys. How do I know that the activation energy for the right-hand side is higher than the activation energy for the left-hand side? This goes back to the idea that we're looking at the energy of the transition state and something called Hammond postulate. The Hammond postulate says that the transition state will resemble the side that it is closest in energy to. Do you remember that? Does Aruba talk about that? Talk about Hammond postulate at all? Hammond postulate is an extraordinarily important concept that when we're trying to figure out the activation energy for a reaction or any step in a reaction, the transition state energy will be closest or resemble the side that it is closest in energy to. So anything that I do that raises the energy of the intermediate will also raise the energy of the transition state accordingly. Anything that lowers the energy of the intermediate will lower the energy of the transition state. That's what Hammond postulate says. Hammond postulate says that the transition state will resemble the side that it is closest in energy to. And that allows us to make all kinds of decisions about stability of intermediates and the energy or the activation energy for the formation of that intermediate. Okay. So absolutely, it is the secondary one. So now I've got a lot of drawing here. So we need to start over again and look at this mechanism of what happens. So what we're going to do is we're going to take and...
Someone in chat asked what you meant by side.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Sterling. You asked, what do I mean by side? Okay. That's cool. I can do that. If I have a reaction which is exothermic, then the transition state is here and the activation energy is here. And when I think about this side as being my energy, and this is my, what I call reaction coordinate. The reaction coordinate is not time. The reaction coordinate is actually the internuclear distances. So if I measure the distance between the two atoms that are forming the bond or breaking the bond, that's what the reaction coordinate is. So it's as the reaction progresses, the distance between the nuclei. The transition state will resemble in structure the side of the reaction, reactants or products, that it is closest in energy to. So this point here is closest in energy to the reactant. And that tells me that these two are close and the transition state will be reactant-like. And so when I say side of the reaction, I mean reactants or products.
Oh, okay.
And then if I take a reaction which is endothermic, then the transition state is closer in energy to the product side and will resemble the product. So by Hammond postulate, what we do is I sort of link these this way by saying those are closest in energy. So the transition state will be reactant-like. In this case, these two are closest in energy and the transition state will be product-like. That means that these two reactions, when I look at these two reactions, the exothermic reaction is more influenced by the reactants. So what happens to the reactants? If the reactants go down in energy, then the activation energy goes down in energy. If the reactants go up in energy, then the transition state goes up in energy and the activation energy goes up. For something which is endothermic, it is the reverse. The reaction is more controlled by the products than they are the shape of the reactants. And so when I look at this, whatever causes the product to be more stable, should have been blue, let's keep with the color scheme. Whatever causes the product to be more stable will influence the transition state and cause the transition state energy to come down, thereby being a faster reaction. Whatever causes the product to be less stable will adversely affect the transition state, causing it to be less stable as well and higher in energy and therefore slower in its formation. So that is Hammond postulate in a nutshell. And we use that a lot, or I use that a lot to go back to how to understand how a chemical reaction is progressing and how to make decisions about how to influence a chemical reaction. And sort of a nice aside from that, which I have to, this just took me a minute to say. When I was in graduate school, I had to take a kinetics class in graduate school, and I took that kinetics class with Claude Bernasconi at UCSC. Claude and I did not get along in this class. I would go to Claude's office hours needing desperate help, and Claude would look at me and say, the answer is in the book. And I'd say, Claude, I've read the book and I don't understand what it is it's trying to say. And Claude would say, the answer is in the book. And I was in graduate school, an undergraduate taking the same class, sitting next to me, would ask Claude, I don't understand, I've read the book. And Claude would say, well, here, let me show you. So it was just how Claude treated graduate students. And which was good. We needed that. We needed a little bit of tough love. He wanted us to get stronger. And in later years, Claude and I were actually in the Santa Cruz Chess Club together and played chess quite frequently. And we had great mutual respect for each other. And he was a fantastic individual. Unfortunately, just weeks ago, he passed away from COVID. And we lost Claude Bernasconi at UCSC. So that's my sad story there for a minute. But I never appreciated how important Hammond postulate was that Claude tried to teach me until I actually started teaching. And as soon as I started teaching and started using Hammond postulate and realized how important that concept is, it is an extraordinarily important concept. So hang on to that idea. And I think there was another question, just to clarify, the symbol that I'm using is called the double dagger. And the double dagger is the symbol that we use to symbolize the transition state. So formally, I believe the top line is just a little bit longer than the bottom line, and it's called a double dagger. And it represents the transition state, symbol for the transition state.
I had another question.
Yes.
Is there any exceptions to this postulate?
No, that's a great question. Unlike most things in organic chemistry where there is exceptions to everything and we never not have an exception, there are no exceptions essentially to the Hammond postulate. None that I can think of, because the transition state, this is such a great topic and I get me going all over the place. Transition states, when we think about a transition state, we generally think of, let's take an SN2 reaction, for instance, okay? So if we take an SN2 reaction and we have some nucleophile that has a negative charge and it's coming in and it's reacting with some electrophile that has a leaving group on it. And this hits the electrophile, knocks it out. And so we get the nucleophile attached to the electrophile, and we have the leaving group that's been kicked out that gets a minus charge. And we can think of this as something like a bromide reacting with a methyl chloride where we're knocking out the chlorine as our leaving group. And as we go through the transition state, we think about the fact that the carbon is undergoing an inversion of configuration. So the carbon is momentarily pentavalent. And what would the correct geometry be called? It's not trigonal planar, but it's one of the larger geometries. But the carbon is essentially has a trigonal planar geometry in the center. This is the transition state. And then as it collapses, the bromide attaches to the carbon, it undergoes the inversion of configuration and you kick out the chloride. Okay, so the question is about these bond lengths and which one of these bond lengths is longer and which one is shorter, or are they equal? And most of the time when we think about a chemical reaction like this, we think of them as being equal, but in reality, they could be one of three different possibilities. It could be that the bromide could be very long and that the chloride very short. And so I have greater partial minus and smaller partial minus and still some product-like or reactant-like nature to this. This is what we would call an early transition state. It could be that it's a late transition state. It could be that the bromide is mostly attached and that the inversion is already significantly undergoing and that the chloride has a much longer bond and stronger partial minus and smaller partial minus on the bromide. And this would be a late transition state. And it all depends upon whether the reaction happens to be exothermic or endothermic as to what that transition state looks like. Or if the reaction is almost neutral in energy, then the reaction would be equal as we have done it up above. And so the transition state gives you great insight into the way that the reaction works and the structure and nature of what the what that transition state looks like, whether it looks more reactant-like or product-like. So early would be reactant-like. And late would be product-like. And we'll see as we go forward that these reactant-like transition states and product-like transition states tell us a lot about how we can influence the reaction ourselves, modify the reaction, decide to do certain things to the substrate or change the solvent or change things in order to control the reaction. So knowing whether a reaction is endothermic or exothermic is important in understanding how do I affect that reaction and how do I control that reaction. Okay, trigonal bipyramidal pokey, I think that is correct. Why would the electrophile have a partial negative? Because I missed it. Thank you. And wouldn't this be endo? This one would be endo, and this one would be exo. Okay, so that's a little bit more about transition states and just understanding this is all part of Hammond postulate theory. Okay, so what I wanna do is I wanna jump back into this alkyne example now. And I want to follow it through and see where we go with it. So let me go to this page. Let's do this first part, which we already understand now. So we'll put the hydrogen in here. This guy we will track. We will track this proton, the grabbing of that proton in order then, and we'll take it this way, to create this guy, which has the positive charge in it. This is now the empty p orbital. There's the proton that we've added so that we can track that proton. The bromide then comes in binding to that positive charge. And as it binds to it, it transitions from sp hybridized to sp2 hybridized. And we end up with an alkene. Now, alkenes are actually more reactive than alkynes towards electrophilic addition, which is the type of reaction that we're looking at. So this reaction, the title of it is electrophilic addition. And because alkenes are more reactive, easier to substitute than are alkynes, this reaction progresses and does this a second time. So now we go through this process a second time, and we take, and we need to make a decision again about which intermediate is more stable. So as we add the proton, there are again two choices. Those two choices are that the hydrogen could, double bond is now gone. The hydrogen could add to this side with the bromide, leaving me with a carbocation. So I'm correcting some of my errors as I'm going forward. Leaving me with that carbocation. Or the other possibility is that the hydrogen will come over here. We get a tetrahedral center. And the bromide and the methyl group, that was supposed to be a methyl. Ooh, I'm getting sloppy. Okay, I need to just slow down a minute. Think about what it is that I want to do. And let's track the second addition as being the blue proton. And I need to catch my green one that was still in here. Okay, so now as I look at this, this one is primary and this one is secondary with bromine. Which one of these is more stable? And more importantly, why?
The second one, because of the polarizability of bromine.
Explain to me more what you mean about the polarizability of bromine. Why does bromine's polarizability make the second one more stable?
Well, just looking at it, it would work as an electron withdrawing group, but it's so big that it would end up donating electrons towards the carbocation.
Okay. I think that that's a pretty darn good answer. There are two modes in which bromide could participate. Bromine, the nature of a bromine, bromine is inductively withdrawing. But resonance donating. Depending upon its connectivity. So what we see when we look at this one here, the primary, let's call this A. In A, the way that bromine is functioning is bromine is inductively withdrawing. That means that it's functioning as an electron withdrawing group. And that electron withdrawing group is taking my electron withdrawing group is sucking energy, sucking electron density out of something that already is electron deficient And what that essentially does is it takes a hole and it makes a bigger hole. It exacerbates the problem by pulling electron density away from something that already doesn't have it. So that is a destabilizing factor or a destabilizing situation. When I look at the other side here, the way that it's connected with the empty p orbital, and this positive charge is representing the empty p orbital that resides here, the bromine lone pair can resonate into it. And I actually then have a resonance structure that I can draw that is the bromine with the double bond. That is such a poor structure. The bromine with a double bond, the positive charge, and then the tetrahedral center. And because of the resonance, this is a resonance stabilizing group. That means that here the bromine is acting as an electron donating group. And what it's doing is it's taking an electron donating group, which is linked to an electron deficient location, a positive charge, and it's dumping some electron density into it such that what I create is an electron donating group with a double bond, partial charge or full positive charge, and it makes a smaller hole, essentially, making the situation better. Let's exacerbate this a little bit, make this kind of bigger so that we can kind of see what's actually happening there. And that then is more stable. So the polarizability of bromine, which is a great term, polarizability means big, soft, squishy. That big, soft squishiness means that when the positive charge goes onto the bromine, that it is delocalized over a larger area. So not only am I spreading it through resonance and spreading it over a larger area, I'm placing the positive charge on a very large polarizable atom, which also helps to stabilize the positive charge. So that was a great term, polarizability. I love that word. It's a perfect word for the situation. Okay, so now that we understand which one of these is more stable, then we understand which direction the reaction is going to go. So that now what I've got is I've got this key structure, and I've got the positive charge, which is residing on that position. The second bromide comes in and adds to it, such that both bromides are now attached to the same carbon. And that's your final product. So what we see when we look at this chemical reaction is we see that on a terminal alkyne like this, it reacts with two equivalents of HBr. The two equivalents of HBr add to the same side of the alkyne, the more substituted side, producing that product.
Really quickly, just if the first electrophilic addition produced something like that wasn't with the bromine, so basically like one of the halide groups is different, would the products then be enantiomers because the intermediate is planar? If all four groups were different, bonded to the center?
Yeah, if you're trying to do something like HBr, and then you're trying to add in like HCl, and you're trying to get something along this lines, and we would then need to maybe even exacerbate this by making this an ethyl group such that I get that. Now I create a stereocenter and I would create a product which would be plus minus or racemic. And the two would be enantiomers of one another. Very hard thing to do because you can't really stop this in the middle. So this is hypothetical. but not practical because you can't really swap up the two acids in the way that we're adding there. Okay, but yeah, that is sort of like one possibility. Let's see where we want to go with this. Let's look at the reverse of this. Or maybe not. Maybe I'll hold that off for a second. Let's slip it behind this guy. Because this will allow us to follow in on this theme. Okay. Hydration, adding water across a double bond. This usually requires concentrated acid. So I'll just put it in there as H3O plus. When we add acid across this, the reaction proceeds in much the same way in that we first protonate the double bond. As the double bond protonates, we create the carbocation. Water then is our incoming nucleophile, which is attaching to that positive position. We create an oxonium ion, initially with a positive charge, and then some general base, something with lone pairs, another water molecule perhaps, something comes in and deprotonates that oxonium ion to give us our final product, which is the alcohol. And we have added water across the double bond. All right, so this is the hydration reaction. Let's follow this out and see how this proceeds with an alkyne. Because what we've said now is that we can do similar sorts of reactions from alkenes to alkynes. We just need to think through the ramifications of what actually happens. So let's take that same concept. And this requires slightly different reagents. So what we're going to do is we're going to use water. Our acid source will be H2SO4, so we need some fairly strong acid. And we're going to use a mercury catalyst. We're going to use mercuric sulfate, HgSO4. There's a couple of different catalysts that we can do with this, but the reaction starts exactly the same way. In other words, we protonate. So once we protonate the alkyne, we just did this. Oh, JC. Am I going just a bit fast? I apologize. Maybe what I need to do is like backtrack a bit. This is one of the reasons that I stay away from PowerPoint as much as possible, because with me in PowerPoint, it could get ugly really fast. If you think I could go fast here, just try me on PowerPoint where I'm not actually being slowed down by having to draw things. So as we take and we add this proton, the reaction is going to happen in exactly the same way that we were following through before. In other words, what we're going to get is the double bond, the proton going out to the terminal end, and we end up with the secondary position. So we end up with a secondary carbocation. The water molecule then comes in and binds to that carbocation position. Yes, this one is also hydration, but it is hydration of an alkyne instead of an alkene. That's exactly right. So as we add in the water, it does exactly the same thing. We end up with this positively charged hydroxyl that then needs to be deprotonated by some base, like another water molecule. And then I end up with this guy. Now this guy has a special name, and we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about this guy. This guy is both an alcohol and an alkene. So let's take that alcohol and alkene, and we'll just draw it down here. So this is an alkene, and alcohol. And what I do is I grab the ene and the ol, and this guy is called an enol. So an enol is where the hydroxyl group is what is called vinyl to the double bond. That means substituted on the double bond. And enols are an interesting thing. They have very strong connection with the electrons on the oxygen, which is in resonance with the electrons in the double bond. And so you can think of this as having a resonance contributor. Where the oxygen has a positive and there's a minus charge out on the terminal end of the carbon. And due to this resonance that these enols tend to have, when an oxygen lone pair can donate through resonance, it typically does, the positive and negative that are here, while seemingly unstable, are actually fairly reactive, such that what happens with an enol is that they tend to isomerize by the lone pair pushing in, the electrons pushing out here, and grabbing that proton back from whatever base originally took the proton. In so doing, enols go to this form, which is a protonated carbonyl, and that base, functioning in a catalytic manner, takes the proton back to create a ketone. And in terms of an equilibrium, what we find is that the enol ketone equilibrium favors the ketone side. And they can self-catalyze. They don't require any acid or base to do this. So this is an equilibrium. And the favored side is the ketone or the carbonyl. So you might say, well, why does this do this? How is it that there is an equilibrium between these two? Well, is there not an equilibrium between water, where I get an equilibrium where I get hydroxide and I get hydronium and two water molecules, one reacts as an acid and one reacts as a base? Yeah, so when this happens, it happens because there's just the possibility that one water molecule can act as an acid and one can act as a base. And I get an equilibrium simply because the possibility exists.
To interject really quickly here, so like based on that equilibrium of water, I know the autoionization of water decreases at lower temperature.
It does.
Yeah. So like if you lower the temperature, would you favor the enol product?
Yes, it is temperature dependent. So This one is tautomerism. There we go, tautomerism, and or tautomerization. And these two, the equilibrium, they are called tautomers. Tautomers are two structures that differ by the location of a proton, versus when we look at an acid base pair and we have a conjugate, two conjugates differ by a proton. So a conjugate base is less one proton than the conjugate acid. But in tautomerization, tautomers differ by the location of a proton. And so they have the same molecular formula. They're just structurally different by the location of one single proton. So that's what tautomerization is. And yes, the tautomerization is temperature dependent, much in the same way that autoionization is temperature dependent. And so yes, if you change the temperature, then you shift the equilibrium to some degree. But one of the things that's really cool, and you guys have looked at IR, you understand IR a little bit. If I take a look at FTIR of acetone, that FTIR has an image that looks kind of like this. And then we get into the fingerprint region, there's a bunch of things that are here. This one falls right around, I think it's like 1730. These are the carbon hydrogen stretches. This is the carbonyl. And then this here, this is interesting because what that is a little bit of hydroxyl. It's a little bit of OH. And you say, well, maybe the acetone is wet. So you dry the acetone as best you can. And after you dry the acetone, you rerun the spectrum and you get that little hydroxyl peak that's there. And where is that hydroxyl coming from? That hydroxyl is coming from the small amount of enol component that is in the equilibrium with the ketone. And so no matter what, when you have acetone, there's always a small amount of enol that's present in the acetone just from the autoionization or the autotautomerization that happens with enols and ketones, which is kind of cool to think about. Okay, so what we got out of this is that when we have an alkyne and we treat that alkyne with water, H2SO4 acid, and mercury sulfate, which is needed for the terminal alkynes, that the product that we get out of this is, let's do it this way, is the ketone going through the enol, and that any time you produce an enol, the enol is fleeting and will always tautomerize to its ketone. What happens if I do an internal alkyne? Here, I don't need the mercury sulfate. These are a little bit more reactive. And not needing the mercury sulfate, I go through the same reaction mechanism. And as I go through the same reaction mechanism, I first protonate it. Now, it doesn't matter which side it goes to because the two sides are equivalent. Water comes in and attacks the carbocation. I substitute, deprotonate, produce the initial enol product, that enol product then tautomerizes, grabs the proton back from whatever base just took it, produces the positive charge, and then the base takes the proton back. And we end up with our final product, And there is free rotation about the sigma bond, so I can draw that in any way that I desire. But if I take a look at my carbons 1, 2, 3, and 4, I end up with 1, 2, 3, and 4. And if the oxygen were to attack carbon number 3, because of the symmetry of the molecule, I would end up with the same product. If it's asymmetric, let's say that what I have is an ethyl group and a methyl group. Now I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. That reaction with water and acid would produce the possibility of getting the carbonyl on number 3 and getting the carbonyl on number 4, and they would be in roughly equal amounts.
Really quickly, you said that the internal alkene is slightly more reactive, and I was wondering why. Is it because there's like strain or what?
The more electron density that we pump into the bond, the greater the coefficient on the orbital, meaning that there's more electron density in the pi bond. And as the coefficient on the pi bond gets greater, that just means that it becomes more nucleophilic, that the pi bond is more accessible because it is technically larger, just physically larger. So when I look at a terminal alkyne, which is more electron deficient than an internal alkyne, the orbitals are slightly smaller on the terminal alkyne, and therefore it's just not as nucleophilic in that.
And that's molecular orbital theory to basically say, like, across the whole molecule now, there's more P character in the nearby bonds.
I think of it more as methyl groups being electron donating groups, and that I have a second electron donating group, which is pumping electron density into the pi bonds, giving me slightly higher coefficient on the pi bond in the internal alkyne as opposed to the terminal alkyne. That can change.
Because there's more like repulsion between the electrons, or like what's pushing the bond outwards?
And that's a good question too. I don't think of it as something pushing it outwards. I think of just having more electron density pumped into the pi bond. So it's not that it's pushing it outwards, but when I have more electron density in a pi bond has a bigger coefficient. So we'll talk as we go forward, we'll talk about how electron donating groups and electron withdrawing groups can affect a coefficient on an orbital. And the coefficient on the orbital is a way of referring to the size of the orbital, whether the orbital is a very large orbital or very small orbital. There's two things that can affect orbital size, which is probably a lot more than two, but two main things that I can think of. One is the electron withdrawing or electron donating nature of the substituents that affect the orbital. The other one is the element on which the orbital is, whether the element is a period 2 orbital or a period 3 or a period 4, that as I go down in the periodic table and I go to higher energy level orbitals, the orbital is simply larger. And so that affects orbital size as well. So there's a couple of factors that affect orbital size as we go forward. These are all outstanding questions. Okay, let me see. We got another few minutes here. We've done the mechanism. We've done ketone enol tautomerism. Do I want to do? Yeah, let's do it. Why not? When you did hydration on this molecule, and let's say that we used H2SO4 just as our acid source, we got a secondary alcohol. But what if I didn't want the secondary alcohol? Was there a way to get the anti-Markovnikov product? You know, we call this the Markovnikov product. Should give it its proper So Markovnikov was the Russian chemist who came up with the concept that the rich get richer, the proton is going to substitute on the side that has the more protons, and that the hydroxyl is going to go to the more substituted side. That's the Markovnikov addition. But what if I want the anti-Markovnikov addition? I'm seeing in the chat, I'm just answering the chat question there. Yes, BB, BF3, THF. So the way that I go about doing this is called hydroboration. So hydroboration was discovered by H.C. Brown, and it is a way of taking BH3, which is dissolved in THF. So THF is our solvent. That is our first step. And then in the second step, we do an oxidation step where we use sodium hydroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and water. And what that does is the boron, when it binds to this and adds to it, the boron adds in an asymmetric fashion. The boron addition is concerted, but asymmetric with the, and I just did that in the wrong direction. I apologize. It is asymmetric the opposite way. The boron adds slightly ahead of the hydrogen. This is better. In boron, the polarity of the boron-hydrogen bond is reversed. The hydrogen takes on a partial minus, being more electronegative than boron. And because hydrogen is partially minus, the way in which BH3 adds to the double bond is the pi orbital attacks the empty p orbital of the boron. And while this is concerted, meaning that bond making and bond breaking are happening at the same time, but asymmetric. The asymmetric nature of it has the partial positive resulting build up on the secondary position, which determines where the hydrogen goes. And so the result, the major result out of this is that the boron adds to the terminal end and the hydrogen goes on the secondary position. Now, when I go through and I do the oxidation, and we can recap on the mechanism of the oxidation, but it's not as critical. When we go through and we do the oxidation replaces the boron and replaces it with the hydroxyl group, giving me the primary alcohol. So what boron effectively does is the boron is, this is still a Markovnikov product. I mean, this is what chaps me about this when they say this is Markovnikov and this one is anti-Markovnikov. This one is not anti-Markovnikov. If you look at the way that the boron is adding, it is adding completely consistent with the partial positive building up on the secondary position. That is Markovnikov. That is what Markovnikov addition is. So the boron addition is Markovnikov. It's just that when you stick the hydroxyl on it, all of a sudden it looks like, whoa, it added anti-Markovnikov, but didn't really do that. It's following all the rules that we expect it to follow. This is the beautiful part of that. So if you're just memorizing Markovnikov and anti-Markovnikov, then you have no ability to assess this. But if you understand the underpinnings of the mechanism, you're good to go. So question, when I take this terminal alkyne and I add to it water, H2SO4 and mercury sulfate, and I get acetone, I get the ketone. What if I don't want the ketone? What if I want to get the aldehyde? How do I do that? What step has to change? How do I control this? Ashley is saying hydroboration, to which that is the absolutely correct answer. hydroboration. We have to use a slightly different hydroborating reagent. One of the key reagents is 9-BBN. It's a sterically hindered hydroborating reagent. And what we do is we take and we do, number one, something like 9-BBN. There's a couple of them. And number two, we do the sodium hydroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and water. And now what happens in this step is now we're governed by the boron itself. So 9-BBN adds this way initially, such that what happens is I wind up getting the hydrogen there and the boron with that big bulky group that is on the boron on that terminal end. And then when you go through and you do the oxidation step, it replaces the boron with an alcohol. And as I replace that boron with an alcohol, I get the terminal enol. And then that enol tautomerizes. But when it tautomerizes this time, it tautomerizes into the aldehyde. What do you mean, no, it's Patrick? I don't know what that one means. I'm losing an inside joke here. You guys are messing around and I'm not catching it. You're leaving me out. You're leaving me hanging, people. I don't know that I appreciate that. Okay, that's all right. I'll catch on to these inside jokes eventually. So now this thing, as it tautomerizes, electrons push in, electrons here push out. They grab a proton from some proton source. As they do, I wind up creating the protonated aldehyde first, and then the base takes the proton back, and we end up at the aldehyde. And so now we have control over what it is that we want to create here, whether we want to create the ketone or whether we want to create the aldehyde. And that's part of what we like to do as organic chemists, is that when Mother Nature says, hey, something is going to go this way, we always ask, well, is there another way that we can influence it so that we can make it go the other way, the way that Mother Nature didn't design for it to go? And how do we control the reactions so that we can make the product that we want to make? That's where we go with that. So that's sort of, you're getting the theme of my teaching now, where I try to present ideas cohesively. I try to constantly remind you of what you knew, how to apply it to the new thing, so that it's not that you are learning something new with no basis or foundation on top of it. We look at what Mother Nature gives us, and then we ask, is there something else that we can do with it beyond that? When Mother Nature gives us selectivity for one sort of thing, how can I control it to get the other thing that Mother Nature tells me that I can't normally get? How do I get control over those reactions? And that's how you find and invent and create new reactions, is by looking at what Mother Nature gives you and finding ways around it. So stands for oxidation, correct, yes. Oxidation, yeah, all my symbols. See, you didn't get me first semester, so you don't have all my little symbols and things that we use. This equals oxidation. And a lot of times if we're doing something that requires reduction, we do it that way rather than instead of writing out all the steps. So we can go through those steps, but because it was sort of review and because I was looking at the clock and thinking about time, I didn't go there. Am I muted? Or is it just some people can't hear me? All right, everybody's doing all right. So it's 1:56. I think I've overwhelmed you enough for today. If you're not tired, then you either have more endurance than I expect or you're not human. I don't know. So I'll stay here for a few minutes if anybody has any questions. I'll pick it up and start putting some things up for the alkyne chapter and start getting some problems, although most of the problems that I had were synthesis, to be honest. And the synthesis ones is where I'm going at the end of this chapter as we sort of get through all of these reactions. I think I'm already behind where I really want to be. But from the questions that I'm getting from you guys, I'm thinking that this is sort of right along with what I should be doing. And that this isn't feeling entirely like review, that you guys are feeling like this is a lot of sort of new information that's coming through. Is that registering? Okay, cool. Then I'm doing the right thing. All right. Keep reading in the book. Start working on some of the homework problems in the book. That's what you should be doing. And I'm still looking for that SL eater. I put a couple of feelers out. I got a couple of no's back, and I'm going to try to put out a couple more feelers and see what we can do. So I'll keep looking for an SL eater. And in the meantime, remember when I've got office hours, they were already today from 11 to 12. Today is Thursday, so I don't have any office hours put on tomorrow, but you can always reach out to me by email if you have questions. Oh, and somebody put up a Discord and they put it out on the ochem@cabrillo.edu email list server, so it went out to everybody. I would encourage you that I found that the Discord to be very helpful for connecting, for everybody to connect together and to communicate and to share information. I think that's a fantastic idea. So big kudos and thank you to the individual who took the time to put up that Discord channel. And I'll be joining it too. And so if you have questions that are like short, easy questions, you can always shoot them to me in that way. In what order of the textbook should we work on practice problems? If you have the OCHEM as a second language, I would say that starting in the OCHEM as a second language is an excellent resource to start with. If you don't have that book, don't feel bad. Just go straight to the textbook and start with the in-chapter problems. So right where they're doing the alkyne reactions and looking at alkynes and the hydration of alkynes, start with those problems that are in chapter and then move to the end of chapter problems. And that would be a good way to go. Is this chapter 9? I believe it is. And BB just threw in the Discord invitation in there. And the OCHEM as a second language is the first semester book because the alkynes are still in the first semester book. Yes, that is correct, Paige. Okay. How are we feeling at the end of the first week? Are you guys doing okay? Am I a good Zaruba substitute? Maybe not the best substitute, but we're doing okay. All right. That's all I've got for you. So I'm going to go ahead and stop the recording. And anybody who has any questions, I'll stay on the line for a little while and hang out to answer any questions that might come up. And if not, I wish you guys a good weekend.